Hey everyone, welcome to our weekly edition of the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. This is Scott Poley here with Tom Costura.
Hello everybody.
And this weekly segment features the top stories that threat hunters need to be thinking about, as well as our thoughts on the subject and hunting strategies. So with that, let's dive into the top threat hunting headlines for the week of February 19th, 2025. What do you got, Tom?
All right, kicking it off this week, I got an article from Netscope titled Telegram Abused as C2 Channel for New Golang Backdoor. So Netscope researchers took a deep dive into an IOC posted on X by a tag from Malware Hunter Team and identified a new Go backdoor, possibly of Russian origin. This malware also uses Telegram as its C2 channel, and while fully functional, some portions of the malware appear to be under development. The malware, as mentioned, is compiled in Golang and acts like a backdoor when executed. The first action the payload performs is to check if the malware is running in the location it expects, and if not, it will read the content itself and then write it to that expected location, which, based on this article and as reported, is C:\Windows/temp/svchost.exe. So the next phase, the malware uses an open source Telegram bot API to establish its C2, and it'll set up a routine check to evaluate if there are commands in the Telegram channel to be ran on the compromised machine. And these commands are pretty direct, with things like /cmd to basically execute commands in PowerShell, /persist to relaunch the program under that same Windows/temp/svchost.exe location. There is /self-destruct to delete itself. And then also they mentioned one for /screenshot, which doesn't seem to be fully functional at the time of the reporting, but it does still communicate back to the C2 Telegram channel that it executed. So the PowerShell commands execute in hidden mode using the PowerShell-Windows-style-hidden command, which is a nice little nugget to leverage for threat hunting and detections for sure. I know we've mentioned this behavior plenty of times, but just putting it out there as a note. But all in all, it's not an incredibly novel form from a behavioral perspective, Scott, but it does lead to the conversation of some of the things that we've seen, you know, kind of continuously growing around the use of cloud tooling for C2s. It's almost feeling like it's the mainstay now. But with that, you know, what are some other ways you think we might be able to effectively threat hunt for like this cloud tool and C2 stuff? I mean, or any thoughts around it, Scott?
Yeah, my biggest thing is all about the behavior itself. Because there's, you know, it's one thing to get backdoored, and there's two different ways you can look at C2. There's obviously ways to look at network traffic and try to distill that down or use some cool tools to help with identifying basically abnormal conversations to some degree. But every time I've looked at backdoors and launched backdoors to kind of see how they behave or, you know, what to look for, when they hit a system, you know, because they're always either trying to execute additional things or trying to capture information, like those two actions alone can be very noisy and also have to be implemented in certain ways. So I always find that usually is a good way to identify some things, like, you know, just seeing that everything will be like you have a program essentially that'll be running PowerShell, and it might not be a standard program. I know they try to do masquerading with the SVC host because that's a common Windows process, except for the location of where it launches is not. So, you know, I think that's interesting. And when I saw this, the first thing I did was pull up Task Manager just to see on Windows system. This Task Manager actually showed the full path of the processes it listed, and directly it doesn't. So it just goes to show how just something as simple as that, and if you're just looking for weird things or, you know, process ID of something, and you're like, oh, it's SVC host, but you don't know the full path, it might just blend in. But, you know, so when I look at things like this, it's like a common thing. One, I think the seeing a lulbin type executable or a system executable executing outside of system directories like system32 or sysfile64, always going to be suspicious in general, and it's abused commonly. And then the execution of PowerShell, and then some of the, you know, the hidden PowerShell commands and what the parent of that may be would stand out. But what I think is really interesting about this is, like what you mentioned before, the screenshot capability not being fully implemented. As well as the persistent function just relaunches itself. Which to me is funny because if it's working, it's going to re-execute itself when it checks in. Doesn't really make sense because if it wasn't working, it wouldn't check in and relaunch itself. So it's not really persistent. I feel like this is a backdoor tool that's being tested and vetted. And especially if it's being developed by, more of a nation state like entity where not all the full capabilities are there, but they're kind of testing different parts of maybe the infrastructure to see how well things check in or how it gets around certain environments to see if it's worth developing more potentially. So I kind of get that feel. Or maybe it's some novice that's just like trying to get into the space of developing a cool backdoor and they're testing out different functionality. That's kind of the feel I get from this. And obviously they got kind of picked up along the way in their testing specifically. So I don't know. I don't know if that thought resonates based on what you kind of think or see.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's kind of how it feels, right? I think those are good points. I mean, when you said it, I thought about it a little more after reading the article. Yeah, I mean, it seems like it's something that really is in development. I mean, they kind of touch on that. But one of the things, like, just expanding on that a little bit is the use of Telegram and kind of having that, like it almost like the tool set has this really quick and easy interface. I'm not saying that that's necessarily not what we've been seeing. People leverage Telegram bots for many things, but it is interesting to see the simplicity of what it's trying to accomplish. And even though it seems like it is in development, it's trying to just do a basic couple of things that it would be something that would be easy to hand off to maybe an analyst on the adversary side, right? Other things I was thinking about too when reading this is, you know, relative to just, you know, maybe unstructured hunts. This is stuff that I've done in the past too, where it's pretty, if you have the right logging in place, it's pretty easy to kind of look through your environment to see if you have systems making API calls out to Telegram or other things, you know?
Yeah.
Like we've talked about some of the Windows services before, you know, things going out to the OneDrive, or we've seen stuff that leverages Dropbox, right, as another example, where they might issue API calls to kind of like use that as like a C2 kind of instance, or Google Drive before, right? So these are things that, like, especially with Telegram, I feel like it, in certain places, I think you would know how heavily that should or should not be used. Pretty quick identifiers to at least look at some interesting things too.
Yeah, and I would say that kind of goes into a lot of things. As our technology and web applications get more sophisticated, API integration becomes more prevalent and common. And just from like an unstructured hunt perspective, just looking at like what kind of domains are receiving API calls and who belongs to those domains, and like, so you not even necessary to discover like abuse of API, but you might discover what services people are using that maybe you don't want them to, or there could be innate risks that way. You know what I mean? So
100%. Yep.
But the API lets you basically validate if they're doing API calls and they're legitimately communicating. That's not a random, like I clicked on a link and that's what happened most of the time. So.
Yeah. And before, like you said, the technology is getting to that place. APIs aren't something that's really all that new to people anymore, right? And a lot of things establish certain API calls almost organically based on how they're configured for specific, you know, capabilities. But don't wait. Don't be the group that is trying to do asset inventory 20 years into the making, you know, like get on the ground floor and kind of track what kind of APIs are establishing connections in your environment. I mean, that'd be a good place to develop a baseline at a minimum, right?
Right.
All right, what do you got next for us, Scott?
So yeah, this is a blog from Signia .co, and basically is an analysis of the Abyss Locker ransomware. So it's called the Anatomy of Abyss Locker Ransomware Attack. And they basically talk about how it targets critical network devices, and the threat actors actually consistently employ the same TTPs. And they're typically targeting VPN appliances, network attached doors, ESXi servers. And then they kind of, how they go through their initial access, they walk through basically anatomy. I mean, it's kind of the name, right? So, but ultimately, you know, encrypting things. So I was just going to kind of touch on some of the interesting things that they call out. And, you know, the first thing they do is they focus on initial access. They mentioned they're using some CVEs, which, you know, it's kind of common for low-hanging CVEs for especially ransomware groups to leverage on edge appliances for that initial foothold. And one of the things I thought was interesting, though, is they also, for credential harvesting, leveraged, I guess, Veeam, V-E-A-M there, a backup system that you use, like Veeam backups. It's ironically supposed to help protect against ransomware. But they have like PowerShell tooling or scripts on the associated with getting credentials. It's like a way to, I guess, get credentials from the Veeam perspective. I went to the, or tried to find the GitHub project associated with the recovery for the credential recovery thing. I didn't see it. So I don't know if that's been taken down because it's been abused or not, but I didn't dig too hard. But basically, they're able to pull a repo that had how to get the recovery or get credential recovery through this PowerShell script. And then they go through some defense evasion stuff. And this is always interesting. One, they obviously disable Windows Defender, but they don't do it. I was curious because there's like multiple things to disable on Windows Defender. If you look at like some of the registry keys that have been modified by actors historically and how many there are that you can change to kind of customize how rigid Defender is, they just disable the anti-spyware. So that was interesting to me, right? That was the one piece they cared about if it was Defender. And then they had some other things to stop and remove EDR agents once they had, you know, administrative or system level access. And they're using also a bring your own vulnerable driver. This is a common technique that's coming out more and more. It's an easy way to get system level access. It's just similar to the idea of DLL sideloading, where you have an executable that is vulnerable to DLL sideloading so that you just basically use it and move in your malicious DLL that it's going to load. Boom. That's how you gain access and you're able to elevate potentially and run your malicious stuff. Bring your own driver, same thing. It's a driver that can be basically manipulated to load your code. And but the thing about the bring your own driver is you can almost always look for those .sys files in non-system based directories or non-program file directories, because you really shouldn't be loading drivers, because drivers do have that like more kernel like access on the system. You should be really loading those from anything other than specific directories, unless you specifically know why. And then they also deployed EDR killers. So that's a kind of a common, there's some things out there you'll see where there's different ways to basically subvert or neuter EDRs. I remember looking into it. I remember the exact techniques they use off the top of my head this moment. But there's a lot of research that's, you know, about that. So that was, you know, kind of interesting. But the part that I really liked that they did was they use a lot of tunneling and kind of like port forwarding use cases, where they're basically stood up SSH SOCKS tunneling using Chisel and native SSH binaries. So they either move Chisel into an appliance running Linux, and that basically would set up that port forwarding tunneling so they can tunnel through the device, or SSH that was there by default. But in the case where it was there by default, you could actually see where they had to sometimes enable the SSH service. So that was kind of a key indicator there. Like, well, it wasn't there, now it got turned on. And then they also dropped in some Windows SSH tunneling backdoor on the Windows systems as well, which is interesting. So one of the things I like about the tunneling aspect is if you think about most attacks, usually it's phishing. There's a host that gets hit inside and they have to move from that host. But usually sometimes things get picked up pretty quickly. And then you remove that host where it initially got landed, because that's where all the activity is originating from. And you kind of clean it up and then they have to like break back in. This whole leveraging these edge devices, especially ones that may not have the same level of monitoring. And then every time you pivot, you're setting up basically port forwarding or you know, tunneling through that device. It's much harder if you're not paying close enough attention to get rid of the entire compromise of your network, because you'll get rid of the host where you see the activity, where the more malicious activity is coming from, and they'll still be sitting on your edge and edge devices they've compromised, kind of like the beachhead approach. So usually I would imagine that happens too, because maybe there are tighter firewalling happening. So it's not easy for every device. Just if you happen to get lucky and pop something, it can communicate out no problem. It also helps you get past a lot of defense infrastructure, right? If you have things that are monitoring things and you're tunneling through other devices that may not have the same monitoring, it's now you, a lot of that traffic is kind of goes undisclosed. So that part was kind of cool. But when you look at some of the SSH, especially the native SSH stuff, one, if they're, you know, using an argument dash capital N, it's basically saying, they're doing no execution on the hosts. It's so it's more of like a, we're standing up a port forwarding instance. They also use the capital dash R, where it's pointing to the loopback address of 127.0.0.1. And they have a server alive intervals. That means basically there's nothing that's going to be communicating back and forth all the time, but at basically a 240-second interval, it's going to be sending that hello packet to keep that tunnel up. So that's always really interesting. I mentioned they use Chisel to help stand up some tunneling infrastructure. And when they're landing Chisel on these environment or Linux boxes, one of the things, like I've mentioned before, you know, they have to change they have to make it executable, right? Which with what they typically do is use chmod. So it's either chmod and plus X to add executable features, or you can chmod and use the different things. Some people just cheat and just put 777. But basically, that's something that's common when people attack Linux boxes and they move their own payloads. They have to then modify the payloads to be able to execute. And they also try to remove their bash histories. After they got everything set up, you can see that they're doing the remove to the var tip dot bash underscore history. Anytime in Linux you see that dot before a file name, it means it's hidden. It's interesting to see where you have trying to remove stuff that's hidden. That means it's very intentional, right? They know exactly what they're looking for. They did some of the exfil stuff like you typically see with rclone. So always kind of good to note. Common tool, it's well documented. You can look for the common arguments even associated with rclone, even if they change that name. But yeah, I thought it was a really good example of how people can leverage and move through networks in, I would say, a more purposeful way. But it's also, I think, even though from a network perspective, unless it's like this host should never be talking to this host kind of behavior activity, it, you know, you might not see as much, but from the endpoint, like everything I mentioned, there's a lot of things that you can say, well, clearly stuff's being set up that is abnormal, and things are happening that are abnormal. And ultimately, right, they hit all the endpoints, I think the ESXi server, with, you know, their ransomware and stuff. But yeah, so it's a good write-up to kind of understand different components of the attack. And I think they did a good job kind of walking you through. So I don't know, what was your thoughts?
Yeah, a couple things. One of the things that was definitely like a tripwire for me when I seen this is that, you know, going back to that use of that kind of masquerading as something normal, right? Mm-hmm. So like the example I gave here where they you know, they drop a process and they label it Apache 2. Or there was another example where they tried to masquerade as a WMI helper tool, and they would put that in place under the app data roaming location when WMI helper should typically be sitting under Windows System 32 or down mm-hmm. program files, right? So that one always gets me. So I think about that, and it makes me, that was the first thing I thought about here, is like my brain started triggering into that whole like, oh, what kind of creative methods could we use? But I think if you just dropped yourself into a fresh environment, wanted to understand if something was there. For me, I think like looking for common processes in very uncommon locations, like under the app data roaming that should never be there, that should exist in under, you know, under System 32 or somewhere else. That's always a red flag for me. It always says, hey, yeah, this is suspect. We should go ahead and look at this a little bit. But it wasn't really clean write up. One of the things I took from this write up that I thought was interesting, and I've seen little like matrices or charts broken out like this before, but in the appendix section, they actually did something I liked from a defender side of the house, for
different layers of it, where they built a chart where they would talk about the key attack techniques, and they had various columns associated with those attack techniques to give you, you know, the highlight for preventing, for detecting, and for governing.
Yeah,
I thought that was pretty cool. I like that little breakdown of that. So, you know, shout out to Signia for that, because that's a great way to translate data that's usable right away. So
yeah, because there's more to cybersecurity than just dealing with the problem, right? Like,
yep,
there's how do you manage it, how do you handle it, you know, and they, I think them spelling out like you described definitely caters to like the deep understanding that like this isn't just a, hey, if we do these things now we're safe, because you know that sometimes when you get those questions from above, like, hey, are we good, and you're like, yeah, it's like, well, you can say yeah, but the really best answer is this is why, like, we're doing all these things or have been doing all these things so we are safe, just because we do these things, not because we just saw this report and responded, you know.
Right. And a lot of the larger companies, and we've experienced this firsthand, right, like a lot of bigger companies especially, they're roles and responsibilities are divided out between their security teams, right? There's usually multiple security teams that are focused on X, Y, and Z. So when you're looking at like an article like this, it's going to classify under threat intelligence more than likely, right? And we're going to, it's going to go to whichever team it goes to and then find its way into the next person and the next person. So having some of those things kind of chained together, I don't know, to me that helps one, if I'm an analyst or a threat hunter, I'm understanding how to go find it. And then you have different things you might be able to do to prevent this from happening. So you can check those parameters, and then the governing section too, right? What are things we can consider or discuss? And then it makes the conversation easier. So say I'm the threat hunter and I'm trying to bring this to these other teams. I kind of have some nuggets to stand on already to at least initiate some smart conversations that could be productive. So I thought that was really cool. It was a small thing, but it was like a lot of volume there, you know?
But I think you could think of it even the other way, where if you're a threat hunter and you're wondering, do I need to hunt for something or something related to this? And you're able to see, how are we governing things? What is the patch cycle for these things? You now have also a good understanding on, like, I'm not going to just chase my tail for hours because I'm looking for something that may never even be there because we already handled it or governed it away. You know what I mean? So I think it's good,
yeah,
to understand that, right? Because or if you can see, well, when was the last time this was patched? Oh, this was patched like 3 months ago. Okay, so I know where to start. I'm not just gonna look indefinitely, right?
Yeah, that's great points.
So I think, you know, it's good sometimes to work in silos, but it's good that the product of every silo is still visible amongst the different groups in that aspect. So yeah.
Yep.
All right, what do you got for us next?
All right. My second one this week is an article from Datadog Security Labs. It's titled Who Am I, or Who AM, all capital letters, AMI. I keep tossing around how to say this appropriately because it's confusing if you just say Who Am I, but that's kind of the point.
They did it on purpose.
It's called a Cloud Image Name Confusion Attack. So Datadog Research, their research team identified a pattern in the way that software projects were retrieving Amazon Machine IDs, or AMIs, to create EC2 instances, and discovered how attackers could support it. The vulnerable pattern allows anyone that publishes an AMI with a specifically crafted name to gain code execution. So if something aimed at this is executed at scale, it could, in theory, be used to gain access to thousands of accounts.
Right.
The general idea of how this occurs works like this. So when standing up an EC2 instance within AWS, you can search the AMI catalog by name, like if you wanted a specific Ubuntu version or another OS for your virtual image. Once searched, you would get a list of the AMI IDs, and then a simple select from that list would allow you to build into your EC2 instance. Because basically anyone can publish to the AMI catalog, including creating a malicious AMI that mimics a legitimate instance by name, this can be scripted to your code to build these instances in about any language as well. The article references examples in Golang, Terraform, and a few others. So the best way to help kind of prevent this from happening is to like include an owner field in your AMI catalog search. So by default, that's not there. You need to include that in your search for looking for those instances to build off of. And by default, the AMI catalog will just deliver back the search results that match best
relative to the most recent published items in the catalog. So narrowing on legitimate owners can eliminate this worry. So Datadog mentioned specifically four owners that you kind of want to look at. You're like, hey, these are clean. The first owner was self. Second owner mentioned would be any of the known specified account IDs from like major providers. So like they're exampled Canonical, Amazon, Microsoft, et cetera. Mm-hmm. The third owner mentioned is Amazon, which is registered users only. And the fourth owner mentioned was the AWS-Marketplace, though this owner wasn't really in the scope of the research for the report, so I'm not going to expand on that one too much. So Datadog offers up a handful of other items for like pre-built code to search using anti-pattern techniques, as well as like coded examples using tools like SemGrep. SemGrep basically allows you to detect vulnerabilities across multiple code bases using complex pattern matching. Kind of an interesting tool. I just started digging on it for about 10 minutes and I have it bookmarked to go back to look at because it was interesting to me. And I wasn't familiar with it. They also discussed the benefits of using an allow list. So in your environment to prevent like potential rogue compromise, like putting an allow list, people always talk about that exclusion list, allow list, things like that. Also, one of the things they brought up, they built and created a tool called the WhoAmI-Scanner that will audit your running EC2 instances to see if they were launched from a public catalog item with an unverified account, which would help you narrow down pretty quickly. All
right.
So all in all, this was, I thought, interesting to discuss. It's a pretty simplistic entry point from the top of how this would work. It's not overwhelmingly crazy. We kind of see things like this and we talk about them quite a bit, like the use of GitHub or PyPI repos, right? But certainly worth acknowledging because we have talked about those, and this is from the AWS side, so it's definitely something to get the word out there a little more and just expand on. But ultimately, you know, what did you think about reading this one, Scott?
So I love this research because to me, this is what justifies like why you have red teamers, because you know natively there's nothing wrong with the way this service tool is built to fetch anything, right? Like it's designed to do exactly what it's supposed to do, and they're not thinking about, well, how many ways can I break this and what's the malicious intent and how I can get around certain things, because they're just creating a very functional service and well thought out too. They give you so many ways to where even if you ran it certain ways before even considering this security risk, you wouldn't even be at risk. And that's how I usually assess that the people who built something built it correctly is, are there ways to run it securely and ways to run it insecurely, right? And if there's ways to run it securely where that attack wouldn't occur, then it wasn't negligence. And that kind of how I wrap my head. That might not always stand up to, you know, the acid test for everything, but that's kind of how I think about it. And so that's what I love about this research is, it specifically is, hey, someone's kind of like, wait a second, if this is how this works, what if I do this? And then they're able to say, oh, that's interesting. I'm just going to grab that EC2 image because it's the most recently named something. So kind of a really cool approach. The one thing to consider is, you know, AWS has CloudWatch. So it's basically a monitoring tool, but it collects a lot of the logging you would need to even see some of this too live, because everything that happens in the cloud space is API driven. We just talked about APIs earlier. API driven. So you'll see the API call to that specific service, and you'll see a lot of times the arguments too. So you can also narrow down, well, when did someone potentially, you know, pull a new EC2 instance? What was it? Did they use arguments out, you know, or whatever? I mean, you can kind of look at some of those things. But the other thing I think is interesting is, you know, how impactful this could have been if this wasn't disclosed and they didn't have this, because, you know, the one thing I know when it comes to automation, right, if you want to have something automate that basically tear things down and stand things up, and you don't make automation so you have to go in and edit things, right, every single time you want to run it or check. You build automation so you only have to only go back to it when it breaks. So there's a good chance you say, always give me the latest image, right, potentially. And then somehow someone leverages this attack and you have automation that's spinning up and spinning down things at a cadence where it picks up some of his malicious images. That could be bad, right? So, I mean, this could be a great attack service that can have great implications if it's not discovered and handled. So I think it's just really good they put this out there. I like how they offered solutions. I like how they kind of created some solutions on top of all that. It wasn't just a, hey, see this and freak out, you know? So that was the other thing I really liked about their delivery with this whole thing. So I think it's just, it's really good research. And I think the big takeaway, if you're not used to reading this kind of stuff, is look how offensive security helps people do things better, because they help them like think about how things are supposed to work and how, if they don't work exactly how you want them to, how they could be taken advantage of.
No, those are excellent points. Honestly, that's not something that I initially thought about reading through this, but yeah, I mean, that's, I think we could shout that a little louder, man. The combination of the thought processes from the red or the blue side, you're coming at it from different angles. And when they're paired together to solve a problem or look at a potential gap in coverage, man, it always seems to work when you have that combination, right? And you got to love sometimes, because we live more on the blue team side, right?
Yeah.
We tend to think like blue teamers. It's awesome to see when red teamers like think outside of the box on how to get inside of the box, right?
Yeah, because some people were like, they just need to get domain admin, and then it's like the red team job. And it's like, well, if they didn't get it, then they didn't really succeed. It's like, but look at all the little things they can do to show you that there's problems, you know? It's not
just about, or things to consider. Right, exactly. What do you got last for us this week?
So it's Trend Micro article, and it's called Loomis Stealers GitHub-based delivery explored via managed detection and response. So basically, the Loomis Stealer attack was basically using GitHub to pull down their images, right, and install on the system and do things to that degree. And so there's a bunch of like GitHub repos they even mentioned about how this is being staged. So we talked earlier, right, like API usage or using different services publicly, like knowing where things are going sometimes is good to understand. This could be similar. I don't think they actually used an API specific for this, but still kind of, I think it lives within the same realm. So basically they were able to pull down Loomis Stealer, and there were some interesting things to note. So whatever file they were using to run the Loomis Stealer from, then after they pulled down Loomis Stealer, they also installed additional malware, like was it Septop Rat, Vidar, Go Beacon, and they even pulled out other variants of Loomis Stealer, which is, I think, is interesting. It's just a way you can update if you have like new release or something. But when they run things, they have examples of some of the things they're able to pull back to get system information. So it'd be like whatever the Loomis Stealer executable is, and they have like type utility subtype, network services, service sandbox type none, like this huge string. Sometimes I like when malware runs with those types of things, only because it makes it more identifiable and easier to be a little more targeted, because you know that, hey, if I use one or two keywords versus five keywords, those two might pull back some noise versus five might pull back more what I want. So I thought that was kind of a good thing to be able to pick up on. And it's more what they use for the discovery process. The other thing I also thought was interesting, and this went across not just the Loomis Stealer part, but the other malware that moved in, there were some execution signs of this as well, but they were using, you know, the command prompt, right? But they're using the arguments /d/forward/d/s/forward/c. That's just a lot of slashes. And the C, people are very common. People are like, okay, yeah, C is basically, I'm going to run a command. The S is basically treating everything like strings. So it's a way to basically how you handle the double quotes. So it makes it easier to pass commands to the /c, which is funny because I can now think back so many instances where things were breaking when I was running them. And if I just knew that argument, it would just simplify things for me. And then the /d is basically don't run any like auto scripts. So I guess this is my assumption, because I didn't dig into this too deep, but you know, just like other things you might run systematically on the system, if you launch something, there might be certain policies to run certain things beforehand or set up your environment or your profile a certain way. And that /D prevents that. So you basically are able to say, I'm going to run CMD native. They ran a lot of their commands that way. So a ton of that activity, right? So already, you know, I don't think most normal people, even when they use some of those command or arguments, they use them all and use them all that often. So they use that to do find string, to find certain things. They even use that to echo and do the environmental variables for the computer name and user DNS domain, echoing that back to get that information. So already kind of an interesting behavior that I think is very identifiable. And then they did do kind of some PowerShell activity. This one was interesting because you're usually seeing execution policy stuff with no profile kind of combinations. But they usually you'll see that with non-interactive arguments. So it's just like, hey, run this script, but you know, use these policies so you can run it with no restrictions and all this kind of stuff. In this case, they actually do the input format text. So it was kind of weird to say it is interactive, but they're going to read from a text file into it in order to execute things versus like XML to basically pass things to that PowerShell session. The other thing that stands out too is I always look for scheduled tasks that are being created and what is being run. Because if I see like WScript, PowerShell, CMD, those type of generic administrative terminal type tools or execution scripting tools, always want to know why those are there. And in this case, that was one of their persistence was WScript. And I thought it was interesting. I don't know if this is a language thing, but they named the service Lodging. And in my head, I was like, did they mean to put logging? And they put Lodging, because I don't know what Lodging would would mean to somebody. If they saw a service, they'd be like, oh, Lodging, that sounds normal. That would be really abnormal in itself to me. So that was interesting. And then they also, one of the, you know, later on when they dropped other malware and it was running, other than the weird arguments with the command prompt, you also see where they're running timeout. So it's weird because I haven't seen this in a while. Usually people do other techniques to kind of stall execution. And now this stall has to do with it removing itself, that process, but it basically does the timeout command for 10 seconds and then remove a directory. And then it points to itself to do self cleanup. So the timeout, I thought that was interesting because you just don't see that much anymore. And I haven't, to be honest, of all the reports I looked through lately, it's just not that common, even though I know it exists. So those are some like the technical details that really stood out to me specifically. Obviously Luma Stealers and Info Stealers, just trying to collect data to potentially send back. They have some other specific like remote access Trojans and things and other information stealers that they drop. But yeah, a lot of the article then talks about kind of how does some of the C2 look and where they're talking to. But I think the things that I brought up would make you successful in identifying that there's something that you should really look into. So yeah, what were your thoughts?
Well, something to do, you know, adding on to what you were saying about all these things. Well, just one of the kind of key points that I grabbed out of this when I was reading through it is the Stargazer Goblin group rung a bell in my head. I don't know why that group stuck out. I don't know why that one triggers a memory for me. But I was like, hey, I feel like we talked about these guys before. So I looked back a little bit and I was like, oh, yeah, we talked about them a little bit back in our July 29th episode of last year. And so if you want, you know, no call back. If you want to go back and check some of that out, what we were chatting about with those group. But no, I seen when they referenced them here for, you know, just kind of a flash memory for folks. The Stargazer Goblin group is a threat actor that uses compromised websites and GitHub repos for payload distribution. They have a couple of specific little techniques that they've used that they're attributing this to.
Yeah, it was like how they stood up and moved GitHub. Like if I remember correctly, it was like how they moved GitHub repos and kept those like refreshing, right?
Kept them refreshing. Yeah. Yeah. It was pretty interesting, right? Like they kept kind of like a recyclable. So it would show like, you know, new commits. It would show like it was active and it would have like,
yeah,
it would pump itself and show a lot of activity around it
like
to
get popularity.
Right.
Yeah.
So they attributed, them to this instance of activity. And yeah, I just thought it was interesting that I seen them again, because I can't think of a spot that I've seen them. We're looking at some of the stuff all the time.
Yeah, I would like to know like that tie for them? Because obviously, other than like the extreme use of GitHub and kind of like the moving target piece, that would be the only direct tie. And I always feel like, who's to say someone just didn't learn that technique? I don't know. Or maybe a person or so, group of group, you know, it's always hard to tell.
And they touch on a little bit more in there. They talk about like the use, some of the attribution points where they talk about the use to deploy malicious PHP scripts for validation and kind of redirection, leveraging GitHub, right? Like that's, I don't think that's specific to them at all. We've seen that be popping up to many other people. But they also talked about like the redirect infrastructure, like the kind of tailored redirect mechanisms that are employed to like direct victims specifically to the malicious content. But yeah, there's more to the Stargazer Goblin thing that's there that I thought was interesting. That's really was the point of kind of harkening back to our old episode.
And because the way that they did that, when we talked about in the past was really, really interesting. So to see them kind of pop up again and be attributed to new activity was interesting to me.
Yeah.
But that's my ad for this.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you called back. I'm surprised I even remember all that. It means I was actually paying attention because that's a long time ago.
Hey, look at that.
I know. Yeah. Brain's working today.
Go, boy.
Yeah. So, but with that, I just want to mention there are some things to discuss upcoming events. And that is, oh, wait, we still have to do your next one, don't we? Or we did yours.
No, you finished all this week.
I was bragging about how sharp I was, and then there I lost it.
I think you burned the currency of saying your brain was working, and it shut itself off thinking it.
Yeah, no, you can put yourself on the back too hard, otherwise you'll fall over. So upcoming events. There's a Top Cover, which if you guys aren't familiar with Top Cover, it's directed more towards management, but I'll actually be leading that one, and it's about kind of like hiring the ideal threat hunters and kind of building that threat hunt team and what that looks like from a few different perspectives. And then we also have our live Out of the Woods threat hunting podcast on March 13th. So the other one was March 5th at 12 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The live edition of this podcast is March 13th from 12 p.m. to 1:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And that's where we can just interact with folks. It's a lot of fun. We actually had some really good interaction in the past couple of them, hitting on certain topics we drill into. It's a good time, so just check it out. So with that, I really want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Throw Hunting podcast. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. And so with that, it kind of closes out our top throw hunting headlines for the week of February 19, 2025. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.